All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Sometimes we get these cases and they just, I don't know, they really make you think about the big picture of criminal procedure.
Right. Like, you're not just dealing with the specifics of one crime. You're touching on these broader concepts that really get at the heart of how our legal system is supposed to work.
Yeah, that's exactly the feeling I got with this Kansas case, State v. Bowen. We're going to dig into attorney conflicts, prior bad acts coming back to haunt you in court, jury instructions, even what happens when the judge answers a jury question and the defendant isn't there. Like all this stuff that, if you're interested in criminal law, you've got to have a good grasp on.
And not just for law students either. I mean, these are the sorts of issues that play out in courtrooms across the country every day, impacting real people's lives.
For sure. So we've got excerpts from the court's opinion, some analysis, a standard brief, the whole nine yards to really unpack this thing. But before we go there, I think a quick rundown of the facts is in order. Mr. Bowen, he was convicted of some pretty serious sex crimes against a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah, multiple counts of rape, aggravated criminal sodomy, aggravated kidnapping. It was a rough case.
Absolutely. And that alone is going to raise all sorts of legal questions. But what really makes Bowen interesting from a procedural perspective is that the attorney who represented him at his preliminary hearing, well, he had some history with Mr. Bowen.
History as in he'd actually prosecuted Bowen for other sex crimes years earlier. So, yeah, that's not ideal.
To put it mildly, I mean, right away that screams potential conflict of interest, right? You're thinking Sixth Amendment, effective assistance of counsel, all that jazz.
You got it. The Sixth Amendment says everyone has a right to a lawyer who's going to fight for them, who's loyal, who's not going to be, influenced by things that happened outside of the current case. And when you've got a lawyer who was previously on the other side trying to put you away for something else, that raises some serious questions about whether you're getting that undivided loyalty.
No doubt. So, unsurprisingly, this conflict issue was front and center in Bowen's appeal. But here's the thing. The Kansas Supreme Court wasn't convinced. They actually upheld the conviction. And it all comes down to this concept of waiver.
Yeah, waivers, right? It's this tricky area of the law where you're basically saying, okay, I know there's a potential problem here, but I'm choosing to go ahead anyway. And in Bowen's case, the court said he basically did just that. He waived his right to object to the conflict.
So how does that work? I mean, can you just sign away your right to a conflict-free lawyer?
Not quite. The court was really careful to distinguish between what they call structural error and a waivable conflict. A structural error, that's like a complete breakdown in the system, a fundamental flaw that automatically makes a trial unfair. Think like being denied a lawyer altogether.
Okay, so that's bad, obviously. But then what's this waivable conflict business?
So a waivable conflict is something that, yes, could cause problems, but it's not so inherently unfair that you can't choose to move forward anyway. And the key here is informed consent. The defendant has to be fully aware of the potential issues, the risks involved, and then make a conscious decision to say, yep, I'm okay with this.
I'm seeing where this is going. So, because Bowen knew about his lawyer's past as a prosecutor, and he still chose to have him represent him at the preliminary hearing, the court saw that as him knowingly giving up the right to cry foul later on.
Exactly. They said, look, he was told about the potential problems, he had the chance to object, and he didn't. So he can't come back now and say this ruined his whole trial.
It's almost like a legal you snooze, you lose situation. But this raises another point. The lawyer in question only handled the preliminary hearing, not the actual trial, right?
Right. And the court put some emphasis on that. They said the preliminary hearing, while important, isn't as crucial as the trial itself. So even if there was some lingering concern about divided loyalties, it wasn't enough to overturn the entire conviction.
Makes sense. But let's be real, this whole thing is a cautionary tale, right? It's a
Yeah.
reminder that when you're facing criminal charges, every decision matters, every waiver you sign has serious implications.
No kidding. And it also highlights the immense responsibility lawyers have to be upfront with their clients about any potential conflicts.
100%. All right, let's move on to another really controversial aspect of this case, the use of Bowen's prior convictions for sex crimes as evidence. I mean, this gets at the heart of one of the most fundamental principles in our legal system, right? You're supposed to be judged on the evidence of the current crime, not on your past.
That's the general rule against what we call propensity evidence. The idea is we don't want juries convicting someone just because they think, oh, he's done bad things before, so he must be guilty now.
Makes sense. But as with most things in the law, there are exceptions.
Of course, there are always exceptions. And Kansas, like many states, has carved out a specific exception for sex crime cases.
Right, and that exception is found in KSA 6455D. So what does that law actually allow?
Well, 6455D says that in cases involving sex crimes, evidence of a defendant's prior convictions for similar offenses can be admitted to show propensity, to show that they have this inclination to commit these types of crimes.
So they're basically saying, look, when it comes to sex offenses, past behavior can be relevant in predicting future behavior. But I imagine there are some strict limitations on how this evidence can be used.
You bet. It's not a free-for-all. The law requires a balancing test. The judge has to weigh the probative value of the prior crimes, meaning how much they actually help prove something important in the current case, against the potential for unfair prejudice to the defendant.
So it's this delicate balancing act. You want to give the jury all the relevant information, but you don't want them to convict someone just because they have a criminal record. So how did the Kansas Supreme Court apply that balancing test in Bowen? What factors did they consider?
Well, they looked at a few key things. First, how similar were the prior offenses to the current charges? In Bowen's case, they were very similar. Both involved sexual assaults against young girls.
So right off the bat, that's going to weigh in favor of admitting the evidence.
Exactly. The more similar the crimes, the more likely it is that the prior offenses actually tell us something meaningful about the defendant's propensity to commit this specific type of crime.
Okay, that makes sense. What else did they consider?
Well, they also looked at the prosecution's need for the evidence. Like, was there other strong evidence linking Bowen to the crime? Or were they really relying on these prior convictions to make their case?
And in Bowen, I seem to recall there wasn't a lot of physical evidence tying him to the scene, right?
Right, which made the prior convictions more crucial to the prosecution's case. It wasn't like they had DNA or a clear eyewitness putting him there. So the evidence of his past behavior became more significant in establishing a pattern.
I see. So the court's saying, okay, in this instance, the prosecution really needed this evidence to prove their case, which makes it more probative.
Right. And the last thing they considered was whether the trial judge had put any safeguards in place to prevent the jury from misusing this evidence. Like, did they give specific instructions to the jury telling him, hey, you can't convict just because of his past? You still need to find him guilty based on the evidence in this case.
That seems absolutely crucial. I mean, you can't just let the jury run wild with this kind of information.
No kidding. And in Bowen, the Kansas Supreme Court found that the trial judge had done enough to protect the defendant's rights, that he had properly instructed the jury and therefore hadn't abused his discretion in allowing the evidence.
So even though this is a super sensitive area, they're giving trial judges a fair amount of leeway to make these calls.
Yeah, and that's important to remember. These evidentiary rulings are often judgment calls based on the specifics of each case. Appellate courts are usually hesitant to second-guess those decisions unless they see a clear abuse of that discretion.
It's this constant back and forth, right? Balancing the need for relevant evidence with the need to ensure a fair trial.
Absolutely. And that tension is especially pronounced in sex crime cases. On the one hand, you want to protect victims, and there's this argument that prior bad acts can be really powerful evidence in these types of cases. But on the other hand, you have this risk of what's called moral prejudice, where the jury might convict based on disgust or revulsion at the defendant's past, rather than on the actual evidence of the crime itself.
It's tough, and there's no easy answer. Okay, let's move on to the next big issue in Bowen. The jury instructions. Specifically, the instruction on aiding and abetting. What was the problem there?
Okay, so Bowen was arguing that the jury should have been required to be unanimous on whether he was the principal actor in the crime, the one who actually did it, or if he was just an accomplice, meaning he helped someone else do it. He said the jury had to agree on his specific role.
Interesting. So he's saying it wasn't enough for them to just say, yeah, he was involved somehow. They have to all agree on the exact nature of his involvement.
Right. But the Kansas Supreme Court disagreed. They said, look, aiding and abetting, it's not what we call an alternative means of committing a crime. It's a theory of liability. And that distinction is really important.
Okay, I'm going to need you to break that down for me. What's the difference between an alternative means and a theory of liability?
Think of it this way. The crime here is rape, right? That's the core act. Now, there might be different ways to commit that crime. You could use force. You could threaten someone. You could drug them. Those are different means of committing the same crime.
I'm with you so far.
Now, a theory of liability is different. It's not about how the crime was committed. It's about who can be held legally responsible for it.
Mm.
So you've got the principal, the person who actually does the act, but you also have accomplices, people who help, who encourage, who maybe plan or cover up the crime.
Okay, I see. So the court's saying, as long as the jury all agrees that the crime of rape occurred and that Bowen was involved somehow, they don't need to all agree on whether he was the one who physically did it or if he just played a supporting role.
Exactly. The key is unanimity on the underlying crime, not on the precise theory of liability.
Got it. So in this case, the court said the jury instruction was fine. They didn't need to be more specific about Bowen's role. But there's one more procedural issue that came up during deliberations. The judge answering a jury question without Bowen being present. Big no-no, right?
Huge no-no. Defendants have a constitutional right to be present at all critical stages of their trial. This includes when the judge is interacting with the jury, like answering questions about the law or the evidence.
And this right isn't just some technicality, is it? I mean, there's a real reason why this matters.
Right. It's not just about being in the room. It's about the defendant having the opportunity to understand what's happening, to consult with their lawyer, to potentially object if they think something's wrong. It's about ensuring transparency and fairness in the process.
Absolutely. So the judge answering this question without Bowen there, that was a clear violation of his rights.
The Kansas Supreme Court agreed. They said this violated both a specific Kansas statute, KSA 22-3420-3, and Bowen's constitutional right to be present.
Okay, so slam dunk, case reversed, right?
Not so fast. Remember that concept of harmless error we talked about earlier? It comes back to bite us again.
Ugh, of course it does. So even though the judge messed up, the court can still say, well, it didn't really matter in the end.
Yeah. That's the gist of it. And in Bowen, they did exactly that. They looked at the judge's answer to the jury's question, and they said, look, it was a straightforward, accurate explanation of the law. It didn't introduce any new information or prejudice Bowen in any way. So even though they acknowledged the error, they said it was harmless, it didn't change the outcome of the trial.
So it's not enough for there to be a mistake. The defendant has to show that the mistake actually harmed them.
Yeah.
That it likely affected the verdict.
Right. And that can be a tough hurdle to clear, especially when you're dealing with these kinds of procedural errors that, while important, don't always directly impact the evidence presented to the jury.
Makes sense. But it's still troubling, right? I mean, if we're talking about constitutional rights, shouldn't any violation be taken seriously?
It's a legitimate concern, for sure. And the harmless error doctrine, it's one of those things that can feel really unfair to defendants, especially when they're facing serious consequences.
I can see why. Okay, last but not least, let's talk about the sentence. Bowen got hit pretty hard, right?
Yeah, life without parole for one of the rape convictions, plus some additional concurrent sentences. But the Kansas Supreme Court did throw him a bit of a bone.
They vacated the no contact order, the one that barred him from contacting the victim and his co-defendants. What was the reasoning there?
It all came down to statutory authority. The court said, look, every aspect of a criminal sentence, including things like no contact orders, has to have a clear basis in the law. And in Bowen's case, they just didn't see any statute that specifically allowed for that type of order in his situation.
So they're saying it wasn't just a bad idea, it was actually illegal because it wasn't supported by the law.
Exactly. And this is something that comes up a lot in sentencing appeals. Courts are really careful to scrutinize every detail of a sentence to make sure it's authorized by statute and that it's not exceeding the bounds of what the law allows.
It's a good reminder that even when you've got a guilty verdict, the legal battles aren't necessarily over.
Right. Sentencing is its own complex area of the law with its own set of rules and procedures.
Okay, so let's step back for a second and think about the big picture here. What are the key takeaways from State v. Bowen for someone studying criminal law? What should they be thinking about?
Well, I think it really highlights the importance of understanding how different areas of criminal procedure intersect. You've got Sixth Amendment right to counsel, the complexities of evidentiary rules, the importance of following proper procedures, and the role of the appellate courts in reviewing all of this.
And it shows that none of these concepts exist in a vacuum, right? They're all intertwined, and how they play out in one case can have ripple effects on other cases down the line.
For sure. And I think Bowen also underscores the challenges courts face in balancing competing interests.
Yeah.
Like, how do you protect the rights of defendants while also ensuring that victims have access to justice? Mm. How do you admit evidence that might be probative but also potentially prejudicial?
Right. Those are the tough questions that judges and lawyers grapple with every day. And it's not always about finding the right answer, but about navigating these gray areas, applying the law fairly and consistently, even in really difficult cases.
Well said. And Bowen is definitely one of those cases that forces you to confront those tough questions head on.
It is, and it's a case that I think anyone with an interest in criminal law should take the time to read and really think about. So there you have it, folks. State v. Bowen, a deep dive into attorney conflicts, propensity evidence, procedural errors, and the always fun world of appellate review.
And a reminder that even in the most serious cases, the details matter, the rules matter, and the fight for justice continues long after the jury renders its verdict.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on the deep dive. We'll catch you next time.